Okay, there are two readings today, and the first can be found in 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 9 to 12, and that's on page 1189 in the Church Bibles. Now concerning brotherly love, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. For that indeed is what you are doing to all the brothers throughout Macedonia. But we urge you, brothers, to do this more and more, and to aspire to live quietly, and to mind your own affairs, and to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may live properly before outsiders, and be dependent on no one. The second reading can be found in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 through to 9. It can be found on page 1178 in the Church Bibles. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ, not by the way of eye service, as people pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will, as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. Masters, do the same to them, and stop your threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him.
Okay, back to our main subject for tonight. God, work and the gospel. Do keep a finger in those passages that Kenny has just read, because we will be coming back to them. This topic, God, work and the gospel, it's a really big subject, and it's one that we can't hope to cover completely in the space of one talk. So, in a sense, I'm not going to try. Here's what we are going to do. We're going to start off by thinking about work and what our culture makes of it. Then we're going to think a bit about the Bible's perspective on work. And then, finally, we're going to see how the gospel enables us to apply the Bible's perspective to our lives. So, firstly, what do we think of work? Well, it's hard to generalise, isn't it? I guess it kind of depends what your job is. And in this room tonight, we've got an incredible variety of jobs. We've got teachers and lawyers and doctors and nurses and office workers and IT consultants and accountants and students and lecturers and homemakers and retired folk and people who are self-employed, people who are unemployed, and DJs and ministers and part-time communications consultants for pensions administration and management companies. That's me. And no doubt all kinds of other things besides. So it's going to be hard for me to speak about the specifics of your situation, because if I went around and did that for each of you, then we'd be here all night. But I think there are enough things that are common to our experience of work that whatever our work situation, we can come away with some helpful insights and principles. So be prepared to kind of take the principles from what I'm saying and try and apply them, I guess, afterwards as you think about these things to your own specific situation. As I say, we cover a vast range of jobs and probably a vast range of experiences. And even within individual jobs, I'm sure there are a range of emotions that come up when we think of work. Work is a massive part of our lives. If we spend, let's say, 7.5 hours a day working, 5 days a week, 47 weeks a year, for 40 years, we've worked over 70,000 hours in our lives. That's equivalent to 783 back-to-back football matches. And that's not even counting the work that we do at school or when we're retired. Short of sleep, there's probably no other activity that occupies so much of our lives as work. When it's good, work can make our day. It can give us great satisfaction and put us in a really good mood. When work is going well, it can mean that the rest of life seems to go well too. And yet, nothing can ruin our day, like a bad day at the office, or the school, or the hospital, or wherever. Nothing frustrates us, or puts us in a bad mood, quite like work. When work is going badly, it can have devastating consequences for the rest of life. Work defines us, and yet it demeans us. How often do we follow the question, "What's your name?" when we're meeting somebody new, with the question, "What do you do?" As if that's the best way of categorising people and understanding who they are. And yet none of us wants to be reduced to just a job title and pigeonholed like that, do we? The workplace can be somewhere where we see the satisfaction and justice of effort rewarded. But it can also be a place of terrible injustice, where those who cut corners and tread on others seem to get ahead, while honest, hard-working people go completely unrecognised. Some of us are fortunate enough to have work that's exciting and dynamic, where we feel we're making a real difference. But for many of us, work can be just plain boring, desperately dull, and unfulfilling. More often than not, Monday morning comes with a sense of dread rather than a sense of joy. Work can exhaust us, physically, mentally, emotionally, even spiritually. To quote a friend of mine, I have a love-hate relationship with work, only without the love. It's a remark made in jest, but I think it captures how a lot of us feel about work a lot of the time. Generally, we're at one of those two extremes, love or hate, or we're kind of at both simultaneously and we're living some kind of a contradiction. And our culture places massive value on work, doesn't it? We work hard for the privilege of working harder. And yet, nothing attracts our cynicism quite like work does. It's just not cool to be keen when it comes to work. We have conflicting internal emotions regarding our work, and we have conflicting external pressures about our attitude to it. It's clear that our view of work, our society's view of work even, is at best confusing, and at worst, completely messed up. So, if our view is confused already, then, well, why do we need the Bible's perspective? Surely that's just going to confuse things even more. In fact, it almost seems in those passages that Kenny read for us earlier that the main thrust of the Bible's sort of teaching on work seems to be just kind of keep your head down and work hard, a kind of grin and bear it mentality, which doesn't seem very positive or useful, does it? That's not going to entangle the mess in our minds. I mean, who wants to come to church and just be told that you've got to work hard? Well, actually, I think the Bible's perspective is much bigger than that, and it's actually really, really quite revolutionary. When I was researching this talk, I came across a quote from an essay by a woman called Dorothy Sayers, who was a British writer and essayist in the 20th century, and a Christian. She wrote an essay called Why Work? I couldn't track down the whole essay, but I got a couple of quotes from it. And in it, she basically says that people are dying, societies are dying, because they've lost the revolutionary biblical doctrine of work. And she's right, the Bible's view of work is revolutionary. It's radical, it's refreshing, and it's liberating, and we desperately need it, whether we're Christians or not Christians here tonight. You see, the modern doctrine of work is basically that work is the thing that gives us money so we can do what we really want to do. That's what Dorothy Sayers says, and I think she's right. Work is the thing that gives us money so that we can do what we really want to do. She says that nobody today works for the sake of what they do. The real aim is money or status. So, for example, doctors practice medicine primarily to make a living and to make a career. The patient is kind of something that happens along the way, a byproduct of the doctor's aim to acquire money or status. But the Bible's view is completely different. Work is not just something that gives us money or status. Dorothy Sayers defines work as the gracious expression of creative energy in the service of others. The gracious expression of creative energy in the service of others. It's very different from how most of us would define work, isn't it? You see, whilst our perspective on work is really imbalanced, the Bible's perspective is wonderfully balanced, and therefore wonderfully different from our own view and from society's view. There simply isn't time to explore tonight everything the Bible says about work, so I'd encourage you to go on thinking about these things in your own time, but I'd just like to highlight two things that the Bible says about work that will help us to get the balance right. There will be a little bit of jumping around in the Bible, so be alert and stay on your toes, but we'll try to spend most of our time in just a couple of places so as to not get too confused. So here's my first point. Work is about mirroring God, not being God. Work is about mirroring God, not being God. And I'm sort of taking that from Genesis chapters 1 to 3. So if you've got a Bible in front of you, do turn to those chapters. These are really foundational chapters for understanding a lot of things in the Christian life, including work. So right at the start of the Bible, in Genesis 1, we're introduced to God as a worker. Genesis 1 describes God creating the universe. And then at the start of Genesis 2, we read this. Have a look at Genesis 2, verse 1. Thus, the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. You see it there? Work. So, Genesis 1, the chapter that it first introduces God to us in the Bible, is an account of God working. God is a worker. I was once at a Christian conference, and I saw a kid there wearing a t-shirt with a picture of the earth printed on it, and then the words God the Builder printed over the top in a parody of the popular kids' TV show Bob the Builder. It's a very cheesy t-shirt, but it's true. God is a builder. God works. Work is a fundamental part of who he is. It's one of his primary activities. And throughout the Bible, there are plenty of references to God's actions as work. If you take in notes, jot these down. For example, Psalm 8 verse 6 describes the whole creation as the works of God's hands. Psalm 105 verse 5 calls God's people to remember the wondrous works that he has done, his miracles, and the judgments he uttered. And in the New Testament, when we get to John's Gospel, and when Jesus is teaching people that he is God, his argument is that he must be God because he's doing God's works. So in John 5, for instance, he heals a lame man, and picking up the story at verse 16, I'll read it for you. This is why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." Jesus came to do God's work. And having grown up as a carpenter, he knew what it was to do hard physical labour as well. God is a worker, and he gets his hands dirty. Literally and metaphorically, he gets involved with his creation. And ultimately, and this is something we'll come back to at the end, Christians are Christians thanks to God's work. Ephesians 2 verse 10 even describes us as God's workmanship. So God is a worker. Creation is God's work, and salvation is God's work. And if we go back to Genesis 1 and 2, we'll see that right from the start, people are created to be workers like God. So Genesis 2 verse 15, have a look at it. It's one of the verses that was in our video clip earlier, and it says this. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. So what is God's purpose for man? Well, amongst other things, it's this. Work. And a chapter earlier, in Genesis 1 verse 26, have a look across the page, we find God saying, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." That's a profound and a wide-ranging statement. But one way in which we are made in God's image is this. We are meant to be workers. So Genesis 1 introduces God as a worker and says man is made in God's image. And then in Genesis 2, God commissions man as a worker. The link is an obvious one, isn't it? Work is about mirroring God. And that should really elevate the place of work in our thinking, shouldn't it? I think that really is quite radical. It gives work incredible value. An incredible dignity. So if we've got a low view of work, if we're jaded and cynical and think work is basically evil, we need to remember that work in itself is a good thing, and it's about mirroring God. So when I'm down at the pensions factory, as I like to call my office, and I'm having a really boring day, I need to remember that work is about mirroring God. Even the pensions factory is an opportunity for me to express the fact that I am made in God's image. It's an opportunity for me to mirror God. And the same goes for you, whatever work you're doing on a day-to-day basis. Work is part of who we were created to be, in the image of God. And that's why long periods of unemployment, or periods when our jobs don't give us enough work or enough stimulation, are so soul-destroying for us. But the Bible's view is, as I say, wonderfully balanced. Because after Genesis 1 and 2, helping us to understand that work is about mirroring God, along comes Genesis 3 to stop us going too far and to remind us that work is not about being God. Because in Genesis 3 we have the account of the fall, the moment when humanity tried to move from being God's image to being God's replacement. Most of you will be familiar with the story, but there might be a few here who aren't. Basically, God has put Adam and Eve, the first humans, in this amazing garden, Eden, with all they could ever need. And he's given them just one command, one opportunity to trust him and obey him. Don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the middle of the garden. But in Genesis 3, along comes the devil and tempts them with a promise of being like God. It's in Genesis 3 verse 5. A promise of taking God's place and being the one in charge of things. So Adam and Eve do it. They effectively try to kick God off the throne. But God, quite rightly, won't stand for that rebellion. And so, in punishment for what they've done, God makes it so that they can't live up to all those ways they were meant to be his image. He basically smashes the mirror so they don't reflect him so well anymore. So people were meant to rule over creation as God's deputies, but all of a sudden that's thrown out of joint. They were meant to be relational as God is. But after the fall, their relationships become bitter power struggles. And they were meant to be workers, just like God. But because of the fall, work is tarnished, is broken, it's messed up. Have a look at chapter 3, verses 17 to 19. This is God's words to Adam after Adam has disobeyed him. And to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. And you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return." So Adam's God-given task to work the ground has become toil. And the ripple effect from that event spreads down through history to our work today. The Bible gives work incredible value and dignity, but it's also breathtakingly realistic. Work can and will suck. It will be difficult, frustrating, and toilsome. There will be injustice and office politics and power struggles. Our experience of work is tainted by the fall. We are workers in a fallen world. And as well as tainting our experience, the fall taints our motivation. Because for some of us, the danger is to have too high a view of work and to do an Adam and Eve where work is concerned, to make it about being God. It's a danger for Christians and for non-Christians, I think. Whether you believe in God or not, there can be a temptation to see work as an opportunity to kind of build my own little empire, whether that's an office empire, or the empire of a glittering medical career, or an empire of letters after your name, or simply the empire of an efficient and well-run home. Work, a lot of us think, is my chance to take charge of my life, to kind of be God of that bit of it. So work becomes the means by which you get security, by which you build self-confidence, take control of your status and forge your own identity. And that means that we end up with way, way too high a view of work. And we either become total workaholics, obsessed with career progression and financial gain and endless hours in the office, or we experience failure in our work and then it feels like total personal destruction because the thing around which we've built our lives has come crumbling down. No, the Bible's view is wonderfully balanced. We mustn't have too low a view of work. Work is about mirroring God. But we mustn't have too high a view of work either. It's not about being God. If we try to make it that, we just won't succeed. That's the first thing I want to say about the Bible's view of work. And here's the second. Work is about helping others, not pleasing others. It's about helping others, not pleasing others. Turn in your Bibles to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 9 to 12. One of the passages Kenny read earlier. Hopefully you've still got a finger in it. I'll just put this passage in context for you. What's happening here is Paul, the great church planter of the first century, is writing to a church that he set up in the city of Thessalonica. And he had to leave these guys in kind of a hurry for fear of his life. So he's writing to them to encourage and instruct them on how to keep going as Christians. And in this little section, he talks briefly about work. It seems that in this church there were some people who basically stopped working. They believed, quite rightly, that Jesus was going to return, but they assumed his return would be immediate, and they therefore used it as an excuse for idleness, and they were sponging off the rest of the church in the meantime. But, says Paul, that's not on. And in verses 11 and 12, have a look, he tells them to aspire to live quietly and to mind your own affairs, and to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may live properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one." Paul clearly wants them to be working, but it sounds like a bit of a dreary command, doesn't it? Keep your head down and work hard, he seems to be saying. It's all a bit Victorian schoolmaster, isn't it? Well, we need to read verses 11 and 12 in the context of verses 9 and 10. Paul is writing to these guys not about work, first and foremost, but about brotherly love. And in actual fact, verses 9 to 12 are really just one long sentence. Paul seamlessly moves from one subject to another because he understands the biblical doctrine of work. He understands that, in a sense, it's the same subject. He understands that work is an expression of love. Isn't that radical? Work is an expression of love. I'm willing to bet that most of us have never even thought that thought before. But it's the basis of Paul's argument here. By working, these Thessalonians would be expressing their love for others because they'd be contributing to the Christian community, not draining the community. Paul himself did exactly the same. He worked as a tent maker, and he reminds them of that in chapter 2, verse 9. It's just across the page. It says there, 2, verse 9, "For you remember, brothers, our labour and toil. We worked night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you, while we proclaim to you the gospel of God." So this work is motivated by love. One aspect of what the Bible has to say about work is that it's about helping and serving others. Good work is work that helps people, that enables us to contribute to the community rather than draining the community. That should radically change how we evaluate our jobs, shouldn't it? So a good job is not necessarily a job with a big salary or with opportunities for career development or a company car or opportunities for travel or even one that's exciting and enjoyable. A good job is one that helps people and serves people. Now there's a danger, of course, that some jobs automatically seem more worthy than others by that standard. For example, if you're an aid worker in Africa, or you work for a charity, or even if you're a doctor or a teacher, it might be fairly obvious that you're helping people. And as it happens, we've got somebody who has recently been an aid worker in Africa of a sort anyway, and that's Chris. So we're just going to take this opportunity to give you a little break from my voice and invite Chris up to the front to fill us in on a little bit about his experiences over the past few weeks. So, Chris, first up, would you like to just tell us what it is that you've been doing?
Okay, for the last 10 weeks I've been in northern Ethiopia, in a town called Mekele, volunteering in a Christian-run youth centre, doing construction and maintenance work at the youth centre. The youth centre has up to 800 kids a day coming through the gates. The system is they spend half the day at school. There isn't enough teachers for them to be at school all day, so in the afternoon they're just wandering around the streets, causing trouble. So the youth centre is there to provide them a facility to go to play sport, football, basketball, volleyball. But we also teach English, computer skills, do lots of HIV and AIDS awareness work as well. And my role was just to maintain the youth centre. With 800 kids coming through the day all the time, it tends to wear out quite quickly. And then do some construction projects as well, just to benefit the community and the kids that are there.
Brilliant. And perhaps, if I could ask you, what was that experience like? So, you know, what did it feel like being out there?
First couple of days were really weird. Go from a Western culture to an African culture. I didn't speak a word of the language. So it was very weird to start with. And you're apprehensive going out into the community because you're not quite sure what to expect. But you take that bold step, and I went out and it was just amazing. Everyone is so friendly. The one thing about the Ethiopian people is that everyone welcomes you, everyone's friendly, everyone's offering you a cup of coffee, everyone's inviting you into their home. They just want to meet you, speak to you, make friends with you. And so it was a fantastic time. The people are great. At the youth centre, the kids are always coming up, wanting to know where you come from, what you're doing, why you've travelled halfway round the world to their little youth centre, which is in the middle of this massive continent of Africa. Why would you do that? It just, to them, it just doesn't make sense. Their life is about sustainability, you know, trying to get an education and then earning enough money so they can actually afford to live. So yeah, great experience, and great just to see how they look upon life and what are the important things to them.
Okay, and we've been talking a little bit about work and about how some work is rewarding and some work perhaps isn't. So could you just sort of talk through us through whether what you were doing out there was rewarding or not?
Some things are really rewarding. So at the moment they're just coming towards the end of the dry season, so it's been great for me. I've had 10 weeks of glorious sunshine, but I do know that the next 3 months they're going to have 3 hours of rain every day, torrential rain every day. And one of the problems is obviously then all the roads are flooded, they're all dirt roads, all the roads are flooded, so it's just mud. They come into the youth centre just plastered in mud, and it's just a, well, it's just a mess really. One of my big construction projects was to build a wash facility for them, a sink and a shower facility with a water tap, so the water supply is a bit intermittent, so that when they did come off the street they could then wash their hands and their feet before going to the youth centre, so they could just be clean rather than just covered in mud all day. And it was really encouraging, you know, all the kids going, oh, what are you doing? You know, why are you doing this? You know, and when you explain you're building this wash station for them and, you know, and serving them by doing it, they're just so thankful and so grateful that you've come to do this for them. So it really fills you with, really motivates you, and yeah, you just really feel encouraged that what you're doing is worthwhile and you're actually helping, you know, this community at the same time. So you have moments, you have days like that, and then you have other days where everything just seems to go wrong. You know, you get up in the morning and you think, right, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z today. And then the horse and cart doesn't turn up with the window frame on it, so you can't do that job. And then a rock falls on your head, so then you delay another 3 or 4 hours. Or you think, right, I'll go and do some concreting now. So you get your sand and your cement, you mix it all up, and then you go and get the hose pipe. No water, you know, because I cut the water off that day. So you have days where it's really frustrating and you just think, you know, I just can't do anything today. And on those days, it is quite easy to start feeling down. And I had a couple of days when I was really frustrated that I just wasn't achieving anything. But one of the lessons I learned actually while I was out there was, on these days when you are feeling frustrated and feeling down and you just think, I'm not achieving anything, I got to the point where I thought, well, actually, you know, I'm not achieving anything because God doesn't want me to do these projects that day. You know, God's got something more important he wants me to do that day. It might be that I just happen to be talking to someone, the fact that I haven't got any water. And perhaps that conversation that day was more important than the fact that I actually did get the concrete mixed up and laid the concrete. So I found, you know, I learned not to become frustrated and that everything was in God's time. And if it didn't happen one day, then don't worry about it, just do it the next day.
Brilliant, thanks so much for sitting down. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, to hear how an experience that's probably quite different from a lot of our day-to-day jobs takes you through a lot of the same emotions. So there are times when it's rewarding and you feel like you're really helping people, and then there are other times when it's frustrating and you feel useless. And I think, if you've got a job that maybe you very rarely feel like you're helping people, maybe just have a little bit of a think about it, because I think even the small things, the boring things of our work can be helpful to people. So take my part-time job as an example. It's very rare that if I'm writing a booklet to explain a company pension scheme to some employees, it occurs to me that I'm helping people. But I am. I'm actually helping them plan for their financial future and understand what they need to do to get a reasonable income in retirement. And when you look at it like that, my job is actually a very helpful one. And it's not just helping customers. Work gives us opportunities to help colleagues, to help staff who are under us, to help bosses, to help families, to help fellow students, to help a whole host of people. Actually, I think it's quite difficult to think of a job that doesn't present some sort of opportunity to help people. But if God's view of work is that it's partly about helping others and serving others, I guess that fact probably needs to be much closer to the forefront of our minds, because generally I think our work is far too self-centred, and we completely lose that focus on helping others, on making a contribution, on working out of love. I know I do. But once again, it's about balance. And once again, the Bible anticipates that we are likely to get the balance wrong. Sometimes we become so obsessed with other people in our work that the whole aim of what we're doing becomes not to help others, but to please others. But work is about helping others, not pleasing others. Turn to Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 to 9, the other passage that Kenny read for us earlier. I'll just read it again for us as a reminder. Ephesians 6, verses 5 to 9. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ. Not by way of eye service, as people pleases, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord, and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. Masters, do the same to them, and stop your threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him. Paul's writing to a different church about work here, the church in Ephesus, and he's tackling a slightly different danger. Rather than the danger of idleness, he here sees that there's a danger of being a people pleaser, of working purely to gain the approval of others, without real sincerity or commitment, of what he calls eye service. So working when the boss is around, so as to be seen and acknowledged, but then slacking off the rest of the time. Can we relate to that? I think we can. I know I can, and I suspect I'm not alone. You see, the problem is that because we tie work up with our identity and our status, work becomes about pleasing others. Either we become workaholics to progress our careers, or we only work when the boss is looking, and the rest of the time we're just kind of lazy and cynical and demotivated. We're working then to please others and not to help others. But Paul tells Christians not to fall into that trap. Why? Because work is not about pleasing people, it's actually about pleasing God. Ultimately, who are Christians working for? Not for people, but for God. Just look at those verses and how many times that sort of phrase crops up in it. So he uses the words, as you would Christ in verse 5, as servants of Christ, verse 6, doing the will of God from the heart, verse 6 again, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man, verse 7, talking about rewards that come from the Lord in verse 8, and about our master in heaven in verse 9. Colossians chapter 3, verse 23, which comes in a passage that's very similar to that one in Ephesians, sums this up nicely. Paul writes there, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men. So here's something to transform our motivation. Think of God as your boss. On one level, that doesn't really appeal, does it? Because, well, if God's my boss, then I can't really get away with an extended lunch break. I can't really get away with the odd white lie here or there to buy extra time on a deadline. I can't get away with secretly mistreating my colleagues in an effort to get ahead. I can't get away with going on the internet when no one's looking. If I work as if God is my boss, I'll probably be very productive. But won't I also be really paranoid? Surely my work will stop being about helping others, and will just be about desperately trying not to slip up in the sight of a boss who sees everything. Which of course I'll fail at spectacularly. Well, here is where the gospel comes in. You see, we need to understand the difference between working to please God and working to appease God. There is a way of working that brings God pleasure. It's the way that Paul outlines in 1 Thessalonians 4 and Ephesians 6 and Colossians 3. And that way involves things like integrity and honesty and sincerity. But work is about trying to please God, not about trying to appease God. It's not about trying to get God on our side. You see, there's one absolutely massive and crucial difference between work as we know and experience it and the gospel, the Christian message. In work as we know it, the performance leads to the verdict every time. So if I do a good job, I get a good report or good grades or a good salary or good feedback or just a good feeling inside. And if I do a bad job, I get criticism or poor grades or the sack Or even if I manage to cover up my bad job, still a bad feeling inside. But, and this is what enables the Christian view of work to be so revolutionary, in the gospel, the situation is totally reversed. Instead of the performance leading to the verdict leads to the performance. I hope that wherever you're up to and you're thinking about Christianity, you find this Bible's view of work quite an appealing one. So, you know, wouldn't it be great if everyone saw work as an opportunity to mirror God and not to be God? Wouldn't it be great if everyone saw work as an opportunity to help others and not to please others? But how do we do those things? How do we actually go about living the biblical view of work? How do we get to a place where our work isn't about identity or status? Where we don't have too high a view of work, but we don't have too low a view of work either? Well, it's completely impossible without the gospel. Because, as I say, in the gospel, the verdict leads to the performance. In the gospel, God takes our lousy performance, our total failure to live up to his image, and he swaps it with Jesus' perfect performance. Jesus, who was the image of the invisible God, who perfectly executed his Father's work, and who died on the cross, receiving the wages that we deserve for how we've lived. And so we get the verdict that Jesus deserved. The verdict, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." God's verdict on Jesus can become God's verdict on us. And that means that the gospel frees me to not always be striving to build my empire through my work, because I'm part of God's empire. And I can go back to just working on expressing the family likeness, expressing what it means to be one of God's children. And the gospel frees me not to be constantly seeking verdicts from others in my work, because I've got God's ultimate verdict. So I can actually start to work with a real focus on helping others, and not always trying to please them and get their approval and just get kind of ticks in boxes. Does that mean that Christians can't be ambitious, or that we should let ourselves be trodden on in the workplace, or that we shouldn't take pride in a job well done? Well, of course it doesn't. But it does give us balance in our view, a balance that's so desperately lacking in our culture. It'll help us to be hard working because we recognise work mirrors God and it's about helping others. But it will stop us from being workaholics because we're not looking for more and more verdicts of, "Yes, you're a hard worker, well done, here's some more money, here's a car," whatever it is. It will help us to be good employees, and it will help us to be good bosses, because we're trying to work in a way which we know gives God pleasure, with integrity, with honesty, and with sincerity. So, I mean, unless you know that you're not saved by your work, when you go to your job, whatever it may be, you're always going to be doing it out of self-interest. But if you know that God loves you because of what Jesus has done, God loves you because of his work, all of a sudden the work that you do, you can do for the sheer joy of pleasing your heavenly master. The great irony of the situation is this: until you work not for your sake, but for God's sake, the work that you do will not fulfil you. If you work for self-fulfillment, work will either be too important to you or too unimportant to you. You'll either work yourself to death, or you'll end up jaded and cynical and lazy. There will only really be rest when you're working for God, a work that arises out of the deep rest of knowing that he loves you. Of course, it's not an instant fix. It's not like the second you become a Christian and believe the gospel, your attitude to work is totally transformed. So, you know, if you've been a Christian for years and you still find that your view of work is slightly out of step with the Bible's, don't panic and start doubting your faith. But what you need, what we all really need, is just to believe the gospel on a deeper level, to take the gospel and apply it to our work situations, to really believe God's verdict on us, and let that shape our performance in the workplace and our approach to work. I just want to end with one final illustration, albeit one that I shamelessly poached from somebody else's talk on this subject. Many of you will be familiar with the film Chariots of Fire, which tells the story of British athletes trying to compete in the 1924 Paris Olympics. And there's a strong contrast in Chariots of Fire between the two main characters, There's a runner called Eric Liddell, who is a Christian, and there's another runner called Harold Abrahams, who is not. Both of them are extremely talented and motivated sprinters, but their motivations are very different, and I think they give us an excellent illustration of a gospel-shaped approach to work. So in the film, Eric Liddell's long-term conviction is that God's purpose for him is to go and be a missionary in China. But in the film, he also says this. He says, "I also believe that God made me fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure." So for him, running is an opportunity to please God through the exercise of his God-given talent. It's not like he thinks that running fast will make him any more acceptable to God. He knows that only Jesus can do that. But his aim is to please God, to bring God pleasure through the way that he runs. That's what matters to him. Contrast that with Harold Abrahams, who says of his what he does in the 100 metre sprint, he says these words, "I have 10 seconds to justify my existence." He stands or falls by his own performance. And the pressure of that must have been unbelievable for him, mustn't it? I mean, can you imagine? 10 seconds to justify your own existence. I don't think I can cope with that. And yet many of us try and carry that kind of pressure into our work lives. So what are you working for? To please God or to justify your existence? That's something maybe for us to go away and think about a little bit. I'm very conscious that I've said an awful lot in the last half an hour, and that there's a lot more still to say. So for instance, I've not really touched on things like whether there'll be work in heaven, or how Christians can best use work as an opportunity to spread their faith, or how we can better relate to our co-workers, or said very much about the specifics of things like honesty and integrity in the workplace. So just to finish, I want to just draw your attention to three resources that you might want to take a look at in the week ahead. Firstly, there are some question sheets, which are here somewhere. Here you go. Now, these come at the subject from a slightly different angle, but they cover a lot of the same ground. And they're exploring two aspects of work, identity and integrity. And they might prove useful if you want to go away and do a little bit of extra thinking, just some extra questions on the subjects of work. There's a couple of case studies on there as well about work situations. Secondly, I'd recommend you have a little look at our church website. There's a little bit of stuff about work there. I know there's a short article on ambition, for instance, if that's something that you're thinking about. And there may well even be some other treats for you there as well. And thirdly, some of what I've said tonight was influenced by a sermon on work that I'd listened to whilst I was on holiday, which is from the website of a church in New York. So if you want a bit extra, you can go to that website and download the talk. It's in their free sermon section. It's Redeemer Presbyterian Church, and their web address is www.redeemer.com. Nice and easy to remember. Just find free sermons and have a look for the word work. I wouldn't necessarily agree with all of it, or at least I'd agree with the conclusions, but not necessarily all of the reasoning to get there. But it will really make you think, and I think it's very helpful, and you'll even be able to see the way it's kind of shaped some of my thinking about this subject.